Chapter 30. Ararat, 2675. In the glade, everything changed. The sky above had turned midnight black. No birds moved from tree to tree now, and the trees themselves formed only a darker frame to the night sky, looming in on all sides like encroaching thunderclouds. The animals had fallen silent, and Antoinette could no longer hear the simmering hiss of the waterfall. Perhaps it had never been real. When she turned her attention back to the captain, he was sitting alone at the table. Again he had slipped forward some years, reiterating another slice from his history. The last time she had seen him, in the silver armored suit, one of his arms had been mechanical. Now the process of mechanization had marched on even more. It was difficult to judge how much of him had been replaced by prosthetic components because of the suit, but she could at least see his head since the helmet was resting in front of him on the table. His scalp was completely bald, his face hairless save for a mustache that drooped on either side of his mouth. It was the same mouth she remembered from the first apparition, compact, straight, probably not much given to small talk. But that was about the only point of reference she recognized. She couldn't see his eyes at all. They were lost under a complicated-looking band of some sort that reached from one side of his face to the other. Optics twinkled beneath the band's pearly coating. The skin across his scalp was quilted with fine white lines. Glued tight to his skull, it revealed irregular raised plates just under the skin. "Something's wrong, isn't it?" Antoinette asked. "Look up." She complied, and saw immediately that something had changed in the few scant minutes during which she had been studying the captain's latest manifestation. Scratches of light cut across the sky. She thought of someone making quick, neat, butcher-like gashes in soft skin. The scratches looked random at first, but then she began to discern the emergence of a pattern. "John, keep looking." The scratches increased in frequency. They became a flicker, then a frenzy, then something that almost appeared permanent. The scratches formed letters. The letters formed words. The words said, "Leave now." "I just wanted you to know," John Brannigan said. That was when she felt the entire floor of the glade rumble. She had barely time to register this when she felt her own weight increasing. She was being pressed into the roughly formed wooden seat. It was a gentle pressure, but that was no surprise. A ship with a mass of several million metric tons didn't just leap into space, especially not when it had been sitting in a kilometer of water for 23 years. Across the bay, lighting up the sea and land all the way to the horizon, a temporary day had come to Ararat. At first, all that Vasco could see was a mountain of steam, a scalding eruption of superheated water engulfing first the lower flanks of the ship, and then the entire green-clad structure. A blue-white light shone out through the steam, like a lantern in a mound of tissue paper. It was painfully bright, even through the darkening filter of the shuttle's fuselage. It shaded to violet and left jagged pink shadows on his retinae. Even far away from the edge of the steam column, the water shone a luminous turquoise. It was beautiful and strange, like nothing he had seen in his 20 years of existence. He saw now that the water was bellying up around the ship, the surface rising many hundreds of meters. Frightful energies were being released underwater, creating swelling bubbles of super-dense, super-hot plasma. The wall of elevated water surged away from the Nostalgia for Infinity in two concentric waves. "Did they get far enough beyond the headland?" he asked.
"We're about to find out," Scorpio said.
The surface of the water was crusted with a scum of stiff green biomass. They watched it crack into disjointed plates, unable to flex fast enough to match the distortion as the wave passed. It was moving at hundreds of meters per second. In only a few moments it would hit the bay's low rock shields. Vasco looked back towards the source of the tidal wave. The ship was beginning to climb now, its nose emerging from the steam layer. The movement was awesomely smooth, almost as if he was seeing a fixed landmark, an ancient storm-weathered spire on a high promontory, perhaps, being revealed by the retreat of morning fog. He watched the top kilometer of the Nostalgia for Infinity push clear of the steam, holding up a hand to shade his eyes from the brightness. The ship was almost clean of juggler biomass. He saw only a few green strands still attached to the hull. Now the next kilometer came out, ropey strands of biomass, thicker than houses, were slithering free, losing traction against the accelerating spacecraft. The glare became intolerable. The hull of the shuttle darkened, protecting its occupants. The entire ship was now free of the ocean. Through the almost opaque shuttle fuselage, Vasco saw only two hard points of radiance, rising slowly. "No going back now," he observed. Scorpio turned to Kuri. "I'm going to follow it, unless you disagree." Kuri eyed her daughter. "I'm not getting anything from Auroscorp, but I'm certain Remontoir's behind this. He always said there'd be a message. I don't think we have any choice but to trust him." "Let's just hope it is Remontoir," Scorpio said. But it was clear that his mind was already made up. He told them all to make seats for themselves and prepare for whatever they might find in Ararat orbit. Vasco went back to arrange his seat, but before he settled in he noticed that the floor of the fuselage was now transparent again. Down below, lit by the rising flare of the ship, he saw first camp laid out in hallucinatory detail, the grid of streets and buildings picked out in monochrome clarity. He saw the small moving shadows of people running between buildings. Then he looked out towards the bay. The ramp of water had dashed against the barrier of the headland, dissipating much of its strength, but it had not been completely blocked. With an agonizing sense of detachment, he watched the remnant of the tidal wave cross the bay, slowing and gaining height as it hit the rising slope of the shallows. Then it was swallowing the shoreline, redefining it in an instant, overrunning streets and buildings. The flood lingered and then retreated, pulling debris with it. In its wake it left rubble and rectangular absences where entire buildings had simply vanished. Large conch structures, inadequately ballasted or anchored, were being carried along on the surface, claimed back by the sea. Within the bay the tidal wave echoed back on itself, creating several smaller surges, but none did as much damage as the first. After a minute or so, all was quite still again, but Vasco judged that a quarter of first camp had simply ceased to exist. He just hoped that most of the citizens from those vulnerable shoreline properties had been prioritized in the evacuation effort. The glare was fading. The ship was already far above them now, picking up speed, clawing towards rarefied atmosphere and, ultimately, space. The bay, robbed of that single landmark, looked unfamiliar. Vasco had lived here all his life, but now it was foreign territory, a place he barely recognized. He was certain it could never feel like home again. But it was easy for him to feel that way, wasn't it? He was in the privileged position of not having to go back and rebuild his life amongst the ruins. He was already leaving, already saying goodbye to Ararat, farewell to the world that had made him what he was. He nestled into his newly formed seat, allowing the hull to squirm intimately tighter around him, conforming to his precise shape. Almost as soon as he was settled, he felt the shuttle commence its own steep climb. It did not take long for them to catch up with the nostalgia for infinity. He remembered what Antoinette Bax had told him when he had asked her if the captain was really capable of leaving Ararat. She had said that it could be done, but it would not be a fast departure. Like most ships of its kind, the Great Lighthugger was designed to sustain one gravity of thrust all the way up to the bleeding edge of the speed of light. But at sea level, Ararat's own gravity was already close to one standard G. At normal cruise thrust, the ship was just capable of balancing itself against that force, hovering at a fixed altitude. Landing had not been a problem, therefore. It had simply been a question of letting gravity win, albeit in a slow, controlled fashion. Taking off was different. Now the ship had to beat both gravity and air resistance. There was some power in reserve for emergency maneuvers, up to 10 G's or more, but that reserve capacity was designed only for seconds of use, not the many minutes that would be needed to reach orbit or interplanetary escape velocity. To leave Arafat, therefore, the engines had to be pushed just beyond the normal 1 G limit, giving a slight excess thrust, but not enough to overload them. The excess equaled about 1/10 of a G of acceleration. It would be a slower departure than the most primitive chemical rocket, Antoinette had said, slower even than the glorified firework that had carried the first astronaut. She had said that his name was Neil Gagarin, and Vasco had believed her, into orbit. But the nostalgia for infinity weighed several thousand times more than the heaviest chemical rocket, and the old chemical rockets had to reach escape velocity very quickly, because they only had enough fuel for a few minutes of thrust. The nostalgia for infinity could sustain thrust for years and years. Air resistance lessened as the ship climbed. It began to accelerate a little harder, but still the shuttle had no difficulty keeping up. The escape felt leisurely and dreamlike. This, Vasco knew, was probably a dangerous misconception. When he had satisfied himself that the ride was likely to be smooth and predictable, at least for the next few minutes, he left his niche and went forward. Scorpio and the pilot were in the control couches. "Any transmissions from the Infinity?" Vasco asked. "Nothing," the pilot replied. "I hope Antoinette's all right," he said. Then he remembered the other people, 14,000 by the last count, who had already been loaded into the ship.
"She'll cope," Scorpio said.
"I guess in a few minutes we'll find out if that message really was from Remontoire. Are you worried?"
"No," Scorpio said. "And you know why? Because there isn't anything you or I or anyone else can do about it. We couldn't stop that ship going up, and we can't do anything about what's up there waiting for it."
"We have a choice about whether we follow it or not," Vasco said. The pig looked at him, eyes narrowed either in fatigue or disdain.
"No, you're wrong," he said. "We have a choice, yes. That's me and Curry. But you don't. You're just along for the ride."
Vasco thought about going back to his seat, but decided to stick it out. Although it was night, he could clearly see the curve of Ararat's horizon now. He was going into space. This was what he had always wanted, for much of his life. But he had never imagined it would be like this, or that the destination itself would contain such danger and uncertainty. Instead of the thrill of escape, he felt a knot of tension in his stomach. "I've earned the right to be here," he said quietly, but loud enough for the pig to hear. "I have a stake in Aura's future."
"You're keen, Malinin, but you're way out of your depth."
"I'm also involved."
"You were embroiled. It isn't the same thing."
Vasco started to say something, but there was a flicker of static across all the display readouts hovering around the pilot. He felt the shuttle lurch. "Picking up interference on all comms frequencies," the pilot reported. "We've lost all surface transponder contacts and all links to first camp. There's a lot of EM noise out here, more than we're used to. There's stuff the sensors can't even interpret. Avionics are responding sluggishly. I think we're entering some kind of jamming zone."
"Can you keep us close to the Infinity?" Scorpio asked.
"I'm more or less flying this thing manually. I guess if I still have the ship as a reference, we're not going to get lost. But I'm not making any promises."
"Altitude?"
120 clicks. We must be entering the lower sphere of battle about now." Above, the view had not changed dramatically since the departure of the ship. The scratches of light had faded, perhaps because Remontoire was aware that the message had been received and acted upon. There were still flashes of light, expanding spheres and arcs, and the occasional searing passage of an atmosphere-skimming object. But other than the darkness becoming a more intense, deeper shade of black, there was no real difference compared to the surface view. Curry came to join them. "I'm hearing Aura," she said. "She's awake now."
"Good,"
Scorpio began. "There's more. I'm seeing things. So's Aura. I think it must be the same kind of thing Clavain and I saw before things got really serious. Leakage from the war. It's getting through again." "We must be close," Vasco said. "I guess the wolves blocked those signals when they could, to stop Remontoire sending a message through that easily. Now that we're getting so close, they can't stop all of them." From somewhere, Vasco heard a noise he didn't recognize. It was shrill, ragged, pained. It was muffled by plastic. He realized it was Aura, crying.
"She doesn't like it," Curry said. "It's painful."
"Contacts," the pilot announced. "Radar returns, incoming, 50 clicks and closing. They weren't there a moment ago." The shuttle lurched violently, throwing Vasco and Curry to one side. The walls deformed to soften the impact, but Vasco still felt the wind knocked out of him.
"What's happening?" he asked, breathless.
"The Infinity is making evasive maneuvers. She's seen the same radar echoes. I'm just trying to keep up." The pilot glanced at a readout again. 30 clicks. 20 and slowing. Jamming is getting worse. This isn't good, folks."
"Do your best," Scorpio said. "Everyone else, secure yourselves. It's going to get rough."
Vasco and Curry went back to where Valentine and his machines were continuing their vigil over Aura. She was still moving, but had at least stopped crying. Vasco wished that there was something he could do to help her, some way to temper the voices screaming into her head.
He could not imagine what it must be like for her. By rights, she should not even have been born yet, should barely have had any sense of her own individuality or the wider world in which she existed. Aura was not an ordinary baby, that much was clear. She already had the language skills of a 2 or 3-year-old child, in Vasco's estimation, but it was also unlikely that all parts of her mind were developing at the same accelerated rate. There was only room in that tiny wrinkled head for a certain amount of complexity. She must still have had an infant's view of many things. When he had been 2 years older than Aura, Vasco's own grasp of the world had barely reached further than the handful of rooms that made up his home. Everything else had been hazy, unimportant, subject to comic misapprehension. The nostalgia for infinity was now further away from the shuttle than it had been, tens of kilometers distant, easily. The shuttle's hull had still not turned fully transparent again, but in the light from its engines he caught the reflections of things moving closer. Not just moving, but fluttering, swirling, splintering and reforming, retreating and advancing in pulsing waves. They came closer. Now the glare of the engines revealed hints of stepped structures, tiers, contours, zigzag edges. It was the same machinery they had found in Skade's ship, the same stuff that had reached down from the clouds and ripped the corvette apart, but this time the scale was immeasurably larger. These cubes were almost as large as houses, forming structures hundreds of meters across. The wolf cubes were in constant sliding motion, slithering across each other, swelling and contracting, larger structures organizing and dissipating with hypnotic fluidity. Filaments of cubes spanned the larger structures. Clusters of them fluttered from point to point like messengers. The scale was still difficult to judge, but the cubes were converging from nearly all sides, and it seemed to Vasco that they had already formed a loose shell around both the shuttle and the nostalgia for infinity. What was certain was that the shell was tightening, the gaps becoming smaller. "Anna?" Vasco asked. "You've seen these things before, haven't you? They attacked your ship. Is this how it begins?" "We're in trouble," she confirmed. "What happens next, if we can't escape?" "They come inside." Her voice was hollow like a cracked bell. "They invade your ship, and then they invade your head. You don't want that to happen, Vasco. Trust me on this one." "How long will we have, if they reach the ship?" "Seconds, if we're lucky. Maybe not even that." Then she convulsed, a whiplash movement that had her body slamming against the restraining surface that the ship had fashioned around her. Her eyes closed and then reopened, her pupils raised to the ceiling, the whites bright and frightened. "Kill me. Now." "Anna?" "Aura," she said. "Kill me. Kill us both. Now." "No," he said. He looked at Valencine, hoping for some explanation. The doctor simply shook his head. "I won't do it," he said, "no matter what she wants. I won't take a life." "Listen to me," she insisted. "What I know. Too important. They can't find out. We'll read our minds. Cannot allow that to happen. Kill us, now." "No, Aura, I won't do it. Not now. Not ever," Vasco said. Valencine's servitors moved nearer to the incubator. Their jointed limbs twitched, clicking against their drab bodies. One of the machines extended a manipulator towards the incubator, grasping it. The servitor then backed away, trying to tug the incubator away from the niche. Vasco leapt forwards and wrestled the machine away from the baby. The machine was lighter than it looked, but much stronger than he had anticipated. The many limbs thrashed against him, hard articulated metal pressing into his skin. "Valencine!" he shouted. "Do something!" "They're beyond my control," Valencine said calmly, as if all that followed was out of his hands. Vasco sucked in his chest, making a cavity between his body and the machine, in an attempt to avoid the swiping pass of a sharp-bladed manipulator. He wasn't fast enough. He felt a nick through his clothing, the instant cold that told him he had been wounded. He fell back, hitting the wall, and tried to kick out at the wide base of the servitor. The machine toppled, clattering against its companion. The thrashing limbs entwined, knives sparking against knives. He touched his chest, fingering through the gashed fabric. His hand came back lathered in blood. "Get Scorpio," he said to Valencine. But Scorpio was already on his way. Something gleamed in his right hand, a humming blur of metal, a knife-shaped smear of silver. He saw the machines, saw Vasco with blood on his fingers. The servitors had disentangled themselves, and the one still standing had begun to pick at the base of the incubator, trying to claw it open. Scorpio snarled and slid the knife into the machine's armor. The knife sailed through the drab-green carapace as if it wasn't there at all. There was a fizzle of shorting circuitry, a thrashing whir of damaged mechanisms. The knife howled and twisted out of Scorpio's grip, hitting the floor, where it continued to buzz and whir. The servitor had broken down. It remained frozen in place, limbs still extended but now immobile. Scorpio knelt down and retrieved the piezo knife, stilled the blade and returned it to its sheath. Outside the shuttle, the wall of inhibitor machinery looked close enough to touch. Jags of blue-pink lightning flickered and danced between different portions of it.
"Someone mind telling me what just happened?" Scorpio snapped.
"Aura," said Vasco. He wiped his bloody hand against his trouser leg. Aura tried to turn the servitors against herself. He was breathing hard, forcing out each word between ragged gulps of air, trying to kill herself. She doesn't want the cubes to reach her while she's still alive.
Kuri coughed. Her eyes were like a trapped animal's.
"Kill me, Scorp. Not too late. You have to do it."
"After all we've been through," he said.
"You have to go to Hela," she said. "Find Quaish. Negotiate with Shadows. They will know."
"Fuck," Scorpio said.
Vasco watched as the pig pulled the knife from its sheath once more. Scorpio stared at the now still blade, his lips curled in disgust. Did he really mean to use it, or was he simply thinking about throwing it away, before circumstances once again forced him to wield it against someone or something he cared for? Despite himself, despite the fact that he felt his own strength draining away, Vasco reached out and took hold of the pig's sleeve.
"No," he said, "don't do it. Don't kill them."
The pig's expression was something beyond fury. But Vasco had him. Scorpio couldn't activate the knife one-handed. His anatomy wouldn't allow it.
"Malinin, let go now."
"Scorp, listen to me. There has to be another way. The price we paid for her. We can't just throw her away now, no matter how much she wants it."
"You think I don't know what she cost us?"
Vasco shook his head. He had no idea what else to say. His strength was very nearly gone. He did not think he had been seriously injured, but the wound was still deep, and he was already desperately tired. Scorpio tried to fight him. They were eye to eye. The pig had the advantage in strength, Vasco was sure, but Vasco had leverage and dexterity. "Drop the knife, Scorp."
"I'll kill you, Malinin."
"Wait," Valencine said mildly, taking off his spectacles and polishing them on the hem of his tunic.
"Both of you wait. You should look outside, I think."
Still struggling over control of the knife, they did as he suggested. Something was happening, something that in the heat of the struggle they had missed completely. The nostalgia for infinity was starting to fight back. Weapons had emerged from its hull, poking out through the intricate accretion of detail that marked the captain's transformations. These were not the cash weapons, Vasco realized, not the major conjoiner ordnance that the ship carried deep inside it. Instead, these were the conventional armaments that it had carried for much of its lifetime, designed primarily to intimidate trading customers and to warn off potential rivals or pirates. The same weapons that had been used against the colony on Resurgam, when the colony had been slow in handing over Dan Sylvest. Scorpio relaxed his grip on Vasco and slowly returned the knife to its sheath.
"That won't make much difference," he said.
"It's buying time," Vasco said. He let go of the pig. The two of them glowered at each other. Vasco knew he had just crossed yet another line, one that could never be traversed in the opposite direction. So be it. He had been serious in his promise to Clavain to protect Aura. Lines of fire were stabbing out from the nostalgia for infinity, sweeping around and scything into the closing wall of wolf machinery. They were very high above Ararat now, and there was little atmosphere left to make the beam weapons, or whatever they were, visible for more than a few dozen meters along their course. Vasco guessed that the great ship, after so long in an atmosphere, was still bleeding trapped air and water from pockets in the folds and crevices of its hull. He watched the dark clots of wolf machinery squirm away from the impact points of the beams, like specks of iron being repelled by a magnet. The beams moved quickly, but the cubes moved faster, slipping from one point to another with dizzying rapidity. Vasco realized, dejectedly, that Scorpio was right. It was a gesture of defiance, nothing more. Everything they had learned about the wolves, in all the glancing contacts to date, had taught them that conventional human weapons had almost no effect on them whatsoever. They might slow the closing of the shell, but no more than that. Perhaps Aura was right all along. Better for her to die now, before the machines drained every last scrap of knowledge from her head. She had told them that Hela was significant. Perhaps no one would survive to act on that knowledge. But if anyone did, they would at least be able to act without the wolves knowing their exact intentions. He looked at the sheath where the pig kept his knife. No, there had to be another way. If they started murdering children to gain a tactical advantage, the inhibitors might as well win the war now. They're backing off, Valencine said. Look, something's hurting them. I don't think it's the Infinity. The wall of machines was peppered with gaping, irregular holes. Carnations of colorless white light flashed from the cores of the cube structures. Chunks of cubic machinery veered into each other, or dropped out of sight entirely. Tentacles of cubes thrashed purposelessly. The lightning pulsed in ugly, spavined shapes, and suddenly, dashing through the gaps, machines appeared. Vasco recognized the smooth, melted, muscular lines of spacecraft much like their shuttle. They moved like projections rather than solid objects, slowing down in an eye-blink. Remontoi, Curry breathed. Beyond the ragged shell of inhibitor machines, Vasco glimpsed a much wider battle, one that must have been encompassing many light seconds of space around Ararat. He saw awesome eruptions of light, flashes that grew and faded in slow motion. He saw purple-black spheres simply appear, visible only when they formed against some brighter background, lingering for a few seconds, their wrinkled surfaces undulating, before popping out of existence. Vasco faded out. When he came to, Valencine was inspecting his wound. It's clean and not too deep, but it will need treating, he said. But it isn't serious, is it? No, I don't think Aura really wanted to hurt you. Vasco felt some of the tension drained from his body. Then he realized that Scorpio had said very little since their scuffle over the knife. Scorp, he began, we couldn't just kill her like that. It's easy to say that now. It's what she wanted of us that matters. Valencine dabbed at his wound with something that stung. Vasco drew in a sharp breath. What did she mean when she spoke? She said something about shadows. Scorpio's expression gave nothing away. As calm as he now appeared, Vasco did not think it likely that the pig had forgiven him for the struggle. I don't know, Scorpio said, except I didn't like the sound of it very much. What matters is Hela, Curry said. She sighed, rubbed at the fatigue-darkened skin under her eyes. Vasco thought it safe to assume that they were dealing with Anna rather than Aura now. And the other thing, the business with shadows. We'll find out when we get there. There was a call from the flight deck. Incoming transmission from the Nostalgia for Infinity, said the pilot. We're being invited aboard. By whom? Scorpio asked. Antoinette Spax, the pilot said, his voice trailing off hesitantly. With, the compliments of Captain John Brannigan.
Good enough for me, Scorpio said.
Vasco felt the shuttle turn, arrowing towards the much larger vessel. At the same time, one of the small, sleek, human-controlled ships detached from its neighbors and accompanied them, making an almost painful effort not to outpace them there. Hela, 2727. One further incident stuck in Rashmika's mind before the caravan arrived at the permanent way. It was a day after the crossing of the bridge, and the caravan had finally climbed out of the rift onto the bone-white level plateau of the Jan Saxa Flats. To the north, the southern limits of the western Hirokin uplands were visible as a roughness on the horizon, while to the east, Rashmika knew, lay the complex volcano fields of the Gliston Heath and Ragnarok complexes, all currently dormant. By contrast, the Jarn Saxa flats were mirror-smooth and geologically stable. There were no scuttler digs in this area. Whatever geological process had created the flats had also erased or subducted any scuttler relics in this part of Hela. But there were still many small communities that made a direct living from their proximity to the way. Now and then the caravan passed one of these dour little hamlets of surface bubble tents, or battled past a roadside shrine commemorating some recent but unspecified tragedy. Occasionally they saw pilgrims hauling their penitential life support systems across the ice. To Rashmika they looked like returning hunters in some brown-hued painting by Bruegel, sledges top-heavy with winter food stock. The buildings, shrines, and figures slipped from horizon to horizon with indecent speed. With a broad straight road ahead of it, the caravan had been able to move at maximum velocity for several hours, and now it seemed to have settled into a rhythm, an unstoppable stampede of machinery. Wheels rolled, tracks whirled around, traction limbs disappeared in a blur of pistoning motion. Visibly, Haldora moved closer to the zenith until, by Rashmika's estimation, they could not be more than a few tens of kilometers from the way. Very soon the cathedrals would be visible, their spires clawing above the horizon. But before she saw the cathedrals, she saw other machines. They began as dots in the distance, throwing up pure white ballistic plumes from their rumbling wheels and treads. For many minutes they did not appear to move at all. Rashmika wondered if the caravan was simply catching up with similar processions arriving at the way from elsewhere on Hela. This seemed reasonable, for many roads had joined up with the one they were on since they had climbed out of the rift. But then she realized that the vehicles were actually racing towards them. Even this did not strike her as particularly noteworthy, but then she felt the caravan slow and begin to oscillate from one side of the road to the other, as if uncertain which side it ought to be on. The swerves made her feel nauseous. She had the viewing area largely to herself, but the few caravan personnel that she saw also appeared ill at ease with developments. The other machines continued to sweep towards them. In a few moments they had swelled to enormous size. They were much larger than any of the caravan's components. Rashmika saw a blur of treads and wide meshwork road wheels, with a superstructure of vicious ice and rock moving machinery. The machines were painted a dusty yellow, with B-stripes and rotating warning beacons. Many of the components were half familiar to her, massively scaled up counterparts of the heavy excavation equipment her fellow villagers used in the Scuttler digs. She recognized the function, even if the size was daunting. There were toothed claws and gaping lantern-jawed dragline buckets. There were grader blades and mighty percussive hammers. There were angled conveyor belts like the ridged spines of dinosaurs. There were rotating shield drills, huge toothed discs as wide as any one of the caravan's vehicles. There were fusion torches, lasers, bozers, high-pressure water cutters, steam borers. There were tiny cabins jacked high on articulated gantries. There were vast ore hoppers and grilled chimneyed machines she couldn't even begin to identify. There were generators, equipment carriers and accommodation cabins painted the same dusty yellow. All of it rolled by, machine after machine, hogging the road while the caravan bounced along in a rut on one side of it. She sensed grinding humiliation. Later, when the caravan was on the move again, she tried to find out what had happened. She thought Pieter might know, but he was nowhere to be found. Quaestor Jones, when she tracked him down, dismissed the matter as one of trifling importance, but he still did not tell her what she wanted to know. "That wasn't a caravan like ours," she said.
"Your powers of observation do you credit.
So might I ask where it was going?"
"I would have thought that was obvious, especially given your chosen intention to work on the permanent way. Very evidently, those machines were part of a major way task force. Doubtless they were on their way to clear a blockage, or to make good a defect in the infrastructure."
Quaestor Rutland Jones folded his arms, as if the matter was settled.
"Then they'd be affiliated to a church, wouldn't they? I may not know much, but I know that all the gangs are tied to specific churches."
"Most certainly."
He drummed his fingers on the desk before him.
"In which case, what church was it? I watched every one of those machines go past, and I didn't see a single clerical symbol on any of them."
The quaestor shrugged, a little too emphatically for Ashmika's tastes. "It's dirty work, as you will soon discover. When the clock is against the team, I doubt that touching up painted insignia is very high on the list of priorities."
She recalled that the excavation machines had been dusty and faded. What the quaestor said was undoubtedly true in a general sense, but in Rashmika's opinion, not one of those machines had ever carried a clerical symbol, not since they were last painted, at least.
"One other thing, quaestor."
"Yes," he said tiredly.
"We're heading down towards the way because we took a shortcut across Absolution Gap. We'd come from the north. It seems to me that if those machines really were on their way to clear a blockage, they'd hardly be taking the same route we did, even in reverse.
What are you suggesting, Miss Elves?
It strikes me as much more likely that they were headed somewhere else entirely, somewhere that has nothing to do with the way.
And that's your considered opinion, is it? Based on all your many years of experience with matters of the way and the operational complexities of its maintenance.
There's no call for sarcasm, Quaestor.
He shook his head and reached for a compad, making an exaggerated show of finding his place in whatever work he had been engaged in before her interruption.
Based on my own limited experience, you will do one of two things, Miss Elves. You will either go very far, or you will shortly meet a very unfortunate end in what, on the face of it, might resemble a regrettable accident out on the ice. One thing I am certain about, however, in the process of reaching either outcome, you will still manage to irritate a great many people.
Then at least I'll have made a difference, she said, with vastly more bravado than she felt. She turned to go.
Miss Elves.
Quaestor?
Should you at any point decide to return to the Badlands, would you do me a singular favour?
What? She asked.
Find some other mode of transport to take you back, the Quaestor said, before returning to his duties.